The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
So, ladies and gentlemen, let me welcome our two guests. Actually, both our guests have been awarded the Order of Australia. Mark Scott is the Managing Director of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Thanks for being with us, Mark. And John Anderson, the topic is leadership, and I suppose, John, you're known for having been the Deputy Prime Minister for 6 years, from 1999 to 2005. So we'll push the idea around. The topic is leading the Aussie way, and feel free to SMS questions through, and we'll take as many as we can. So, gentlemen, let me kick off this way. I was in Martin Place handing out leaflets last week, and I saw our foreign minister go past. And in other countries, I guess he would have been in a motorcade with sirens and outriders on motorbikes and so on. But in this country, Mr. Carr walked up Martin Place carrying a backpack on his own. People saw him and said, "Hey, there's Bob," and so on.
Was he reading a book at the time?
Listening to one.
Probably had it in the backpack. But I just thought, isn't that Australia? I'd like to ask you, do you think there are particular things about leadership in Australia? Are there things that are unique about our culture and the way that you lead Aussies?
Look, I think the key is Australians do look for authenticity. They hate people who put on the dog. Jack's as good as his mate. In many ways, that's very desirable and reflects the idea that you don't want your leaders to lord it over you. On servant leadership. Sometimes I think it plays out a little too much the other way in Australia, in that we lop the tall poppies. And good and capable people feel, you know, that I'm not going to be welcome if I put forward my ideas and so forth. If they don't like them, they won't attack the ideas, they'll attack me. So it can be taken too far. But Charles Colson, I think, usefully claimed from a Christian perspective, the leader you want is the one that doesn't want the job.
Mm. Okay. Yep.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. I think there's a lot of engagement around the topic of leadership in Australia. I think if you look at the political debate as it's rolled out in the last few years, there's always a lot of discussion about the nature of leadership. And I think one of the Australian characteristics is that you look for that leadership in a range of different places. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion and writing in recent years on what are the attributes to be captain of the Australian cricket team, as well as being Prime Minister and leadership in other roles. But I think there is that sense that if you take yourself too seriously, if you're too puffed up, if you put too much weight on your own importance, the organism will reject those characteristics. So in a sense, I think there is an attribute about low-key, focused servant leadership, a sense of humility that is quite important in an Australian context, and that's kind of what we're looking for. But I don't think that belittles the importance that we put on leadership and the value of strong leadership in an Australian environment.
Do you think we put unrealistic expectations on our high-profile leaders in politics, in business?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think if, in fact, you take a view that the leader can cut through all complexity, all challenges that are placed on the environment, and that one man or one woman can bear that all that burden and bring about all that change, I mean, I think that's an oversimplification. And I do think at times the reporting that will happen around leadership puts an overdue emphasis on an individual and the control that an individual can have on the full gamut of circumstances that individual might face. But I do think it's a subject area that's valuable to study and to look at the different attributes and characteristics and how people have, say, approached a similar role with similar burdens and the different approaches that they've had and what's made some people successful and other people not as successful. Mm. Mm.
I think we do. I think it's a very big problem for us, quite frankly. I think as any sort of consensus on core values continues to evaporate in Australia, it becomes very hard for a leader to find common cause with enough people to take things forward. And I consistently noted when I was in public life that if I did something that people liked, whether it was good or not, I was a leader. But if I did something that they didn't like, you're not listening, you're no leader. And you'll see the point. Actually, a leader has to often do things that are not liked.
Yeah. I sometimes think there's a simplistic desire to have for a leader to deliver the complete package, the whole solution to everything. And it was one of the experiences I think I had when I started at the ABC. I sat down for the first 100 days or so, and I tried to think and work through, well, where was the organisation going to be in 5 years' time? What was the future of broadcasting? What impact would the internet play? What would happen to our traditional broadcast arms? What would international competitors do to us? And I think after about 100 days, I was more confused than ever. All you knew is that it was all changing very quickly. It was all very unpredictable. There were a whole series of variables over which you'd have no control. But fundamentally, the future was that way. You know, as an organisation, we're heading that way. And if we move with some purpose and some momentum and we take advantage of our opportunities and we develop these kinds of attributes as an organisation, that would be success. And so in a sense, saying to the organisation that you don't have certainty, you can't give guarantees, there are no assurances, but we know the kind of organisation we need to be, we know the kind of decisions we need to take, we know the direction where we need to tend, then that might be as all that a leader can do, but that might be satisfactory if you explain to the organisation that that's all a leader can do.
Yep. I think, by the way, that he did an excellent job at that. I really do.
Thank you, Sean.
We've got a question.
What I'm waiting for is someone from the ABC to say that
I did. John, come on. Come on, John. Our airwaves
but
are always...
But I do mean it. I do mean it.
Our airwaves are always open, John.
But I did hear you summarise your views at a meeting about 5 years ago, and I thought you did it superbly. Yeah,
we have a question via SMS. Aussies love authentic leaders. I think you mentioned that, John. What does it mean to you both? What would authenticity look like? What does it look like as you do your job, two big, difficult jobs that you've got?
Well, I think there's a great... One of the things I suppose I've reflected on is whether the organisation thinks you're credible or not, and whether in fact the more they look at you and the more they listen to you and they look at not just what you're saying publicly but how you're delivering that privately, is there a credibility gap around that or not? And I think if people feel that there is a credibility gap, that you're not authentic, you're not real, then they're far less likely to trust you, they're far more likely to step back and be very guarded.
You mean, do you have the same face and personality publicly and privately?
I think so,
I think the Australian people pick up on that.
Yeah.
Probably actually our perspectives would be slightly different there, because when you're in public life, the Australian people are very stern taskmasters.
Yeah.
And it takes a long time to win people's confidence and trust. They do have an extraordinary sort of sixth sense for it, though. They do, after a while, I think, settle on a reasonable understanding of their very senior leaders when they've been around long enough. I do believe that. And for my own part, I'd have to say that for me, I think the radical crossover point between Christianity and public policy is this idea that all have dignity, all have matter, that the serf must respect the king, but the king must also respect the serf. And I found in public life it was a very useful antidote to pride to consistently try and remind yourself that you're standing before the Almighty was completely different to your own idea of your own importance, if that makes sense. And that when I met a really... And I had a lot of them in my electorate. Many of Australia's poorest electorates now are rural ones, and I had one. And I remember meeting... It only happened to me once, but I had an Indigenous lad who got so upset with... I can't say with me, but with the world he was living in, he spat at me. In one of my outback towns. And I remember thinking, now I've just got to remember that I've got no greater standing before the Almighty than he does, and vice versa. Because pride is usually the problem in Australia that leads to the manifestations of characteristics, I suppose, that people pick up and they don't like.
But is that easily built into leadership? You get treated like you're important often enough, do you start to, hypothetically, could you start to believe it of yourself?
Well, sure. I think that's one of the great temptations, actually, that having the job is becomes more important than what you want to do by having the job, in a sense. And that there are all these trappings that come with status and money and prestige and how people treat you. And I think there are umpteen case studies that people can see and can identify of leaders who've come to believe that and accept all that. And that becomes their driving motivation. I think that's one of the things that really the GFC put a harsh light on, I think, in some sectors. And so I think you do get that. I mean, one of the challenges I think about political life, I mean, I work, I suppose, around politics, but I'm certainly not a politician. But one of the things I think that's interesting about political life is the difficulty that the whole construct creates so that leaders can't actually say, I don't know. You have to project certainty. And Julia Gillard, I think, was asked about this on Q&A the other night, about doubts, uncertainty, when she didn't know the answer. Well, I think still in our political discourse, it's very hard for anyone to say that. You actually have to continue to just indicate that you have absolute certainty, that you have no doubt, that there's absolute clarity in the direction you're taking or the policy proposals you have. Well, actually, that's not what life is like at all, and that's not what leadership is like at all, and that's not how the complexity of modern operating environments operate in. But I think we absolutely expect that. And I think it's often out of almost overemphasising a certainty or a clarity of understanding that politicians find themselves in very difficult situations down the track when the world hasn't panned out the way that they indicated it would.
It is actually one of the great ironies of an age when we are smugly wedded, as the Asian Wall Street Journal put it the other day, to moral relativism, that we ask our leaders to perceive that we never apply in our own judgments, ethical or otherwise, in our own everyday lives.
Well, if I could ask you a personal question then. A mate of mine likens leadership to being a swan, okay? It's nothing to do with treasure or any of that sort of thing. Like, I mean, really, swan feathers, everything. That as you see a swan swim across a lake, serene, beautiful, calm, and underneath, paddling madly, okay? There must be times when you don't actually know what to do in the middle of a crisis and so on, and John, if I may ask you, you were acting Prime Minister September 11, 2001. When you don't know what to, is it better to actually show that we don't know, or have you got to be the swan all the time?
There's a balance, but I remember thinking then, as I confronted the whole range of horrific possibilities that piled in, it was also the week that ANZAC failed, some of you may recall. I quipped this morning that are there any New Zealanders present? It's very important you remember it was a New Zealand airline, all right? No one from New Zealand? Yeah, there are.
Yeah, they're all up the back.
It belonged to you.
Up the back, yeah.
And it failed. Now, I'm sorry if that's offensive, but, I mean, it doesn't matter. It's not as if you're going to go home, is it?
So it could turn nasty.
I don't mean
he
that.
He said that.
I don't mean that at all.
Please come
We're
back next
friends.
Week. We're great friends. I'd love you to come back next week.
We're great friends. I don't mean it that way at all. But it was a shocking week. And then, of course, that happened. We didn't know whether the PM was all right for a while. I mean, where is he? The early advice was this may be the first of a series of intended rolling attacks. We had a picture up here of Jim Wallace a moment ago. Such counter-terrorism arrangements as we had ready to trip that night were put in place, had been designed by him. We tripped all of those and all the rest of it. An aeroplane diverted from turned around on its way to the west coast of America, and we thought we'd bring it into Sydney, and until somebody on board panicked and said there's someone playing a computer game, we think it's suspicious, so we sent it to Brisbane instead. But in the midst of all of this,
the old journo and me is itching here. These are very good stories.
Well, we just thought they'd foil their plans.
Yeah.
But in the midst of all of this, it occurred to me in my total exhaustion, having been up two nights and so forth, something that's easily misunderstood by journalists. But I thought, I actually better get a couple of hours sleep because tomorrow morning I've got to go in as early as I can, get every bit of information I can from Defence, from ASIO, from the Australian Federal Police and so forth, and I then have to look calm. And people still pull me up in the streets and say, I was really frightened that day. I was so glad that you looked calm. Now, was I calm? No. I was before the Almighty. I don't mind confessing to you, I spent a bit of time on my knees, and that was immensely important. But no, I can tell you, the wheels of everything, personally, the apparatus around me, the cabinet. Those are the moments when you've got to say, this isn't about me, it doesn't matter if I get crunched, it's about the Australian people. But there was a big part of it that said, I need to calm as much as I can people's concerns.
Yeah, I think there is a difference between needing to provide reassurance and confidence to your people at the time of crisis, that we're going to get through this together. It's a difficult day, but it's going to be all right, and we're going to stick together and we will survive this. At the same time as I think being with that team that you need to pull together behind the closed doors, yeah. Very open and robust and frank, and not kidding them that you have all the answers yourself and just do as I say. I mean, I suppose I take a view of leadership that says I often like to surround myself with people who are smarter than me, who know more than me, who often have more experience than me, and my role as leader is to kind of coordinate and facilitate that conversation, that dialogue, that the wisdom is in the room, and your job as leader is to be able to extract that wisdom, and then finally to make a judgment call if there isn't consensus around that, what's the best way forward. And that, I think, is going back to your swan analogy, that's all the work that's happening in a very intense environment behind the door, so that you can actually then go out and say to the larger organisation or say to the broader community that this is what we know, this is what we understand, this is what we don't yet understand, but this is what we're going to do. And I'm struck, you know, I certainly haven't had leadership roles like John has, but in running a
that's where the
large,
real power is, that's what he means.
No, but when you're running large, complex organisations, you will have moments where you have to face and deal with that. And they are, I think, moments when the whole organisation's watching you, and how you handle those moments of stress or demand, that's where, in fact, as a leader, you can build capital and build respect, or you can erode it on how you handle those moments of truth, I think.
Eisenhower, General Eisenhower, D-Day, delayed with bad weather. That hundreds of thousands of troops depending upon him making the right decision about when to go, took endless advice from the meteorologists, from the military people, from the planners, from this group, from that group. Churchill, which would have been the biggest nightmare of all, breathing over his shoulder. Roosevelt coming in from the United States. He made it very plain he wanted all of their advice as he paced the floor, puffing away on a cigarette. Ultimately, he had to make a decision. He was probably still churning over inside as much as any of them, but he couldn't afford to let anyone see that. We go at such and such a time. Everything hinged on that being the right moment. He called it right, as we now know, and he must have still been in turmoil, but he had to show his troops that he believed in the judgment that he had made.
Question here about our culture, and perhaps picking up the idea of us asking too much of our leaders. Is there something in our culture that actually likes to see leaders fail or fall? Is there something perverse in our culture, maybe I'd put it?
I want to hear John on this, but I do think it's interesting. I don't think you travel around many countries in the world where they would talk about the tall poppy syndrome the way that we talk about the tall poppy syndrome. I don't think you'd go into Europe or certainly go into the US and say that there is that sense in the culture that says once people get to a certain height, we quite like to prune back and to bring them back down. But why do you think that is the case here?
I think to be frank, it probably does go back to our origins, that resentment of authority. And there's a strange streak here. We were talking about leadership earlier. There's another side of this. Every school I go to wants me to talk to a group somewhere about leadership. And I'll often say to them, hang on, you're teaching the other side, civics. You know? You work out in your own mind what you think a leader is. Henry Ford II said, a person who can form a vision, articulate it to others, and then has the personal qualities to make them work with him to achieve it. There's a definition for you. But you shouldn't just sort of think that through in terms of wanting to be a leadership yourself. You need to develop a template as to what you expect from your leaders. So I do think we get this double standard here. Unfortunately, we, on the one hand, want people to lead, but on the other hand, we want the right to sort of pull them down a bit too readily.
So you think we've got a room full of people here? If we ran a seminar next week on how to be a good follower, we might not fill the room. Is that kind of how we're a little double standards?
It's not a bad question in a way, is it? It's not a bad question. Because nearly all of us will be leaders at some point in our lives for a limited period of time with a limited amount of influence. For the great majority of our lives, we actually will be determining whether or not we're going to be sensible followers. That's the reality for most of us most of the time. And I'm not sure that we actually do get that all that right. Mm. I'll say something. This is not political, okay? It really isn't. But there's a lot of political turmoil in the country at the moment, and I think the Australian people sense very, very deeply that things are not going well in the Western world. I think that's a fair statement. Can I say to you, this is going to require all Australians, if we're to maximise our opportunities, make the best of the way going forward, all of us to be engaged, and we are going to have to be prepared, regardless of what happens on September the 14th, to wear a fair bit of stuff that we don't like. Can I put that to you? As taxpayers and Australians, that's what we're going to have to do. Well, how are we going to handle it? And I'll be really blunt. I reckon I could trace through a few incidences in recent years where Australians have not responded well as they might have, to some of the decisions that have really been needed in the interests of our children and our grandchildren.
Let me pick up the idea of culture. As I read about leadership and so on, or talk with people, the idea that a group, whatever the group is, organisation, company, church, whatever, becomes like its leader in culture and so on. You've both, Mark, you led a huge organisation. Do you agree with that? Do you feel like you're able to affect the culture of the ABC? How do you as one individual try and do that?
Yeah. Look, I think what's interesting about an organisation like the ABC is that it clearly had a strong organisational culture before I arrived. And it will have a strong organisational culture after you go. And some of the readings I did around organisational culture said that if, in fact, you had an organisation where there hadn't been great turnover of numbers in its core, but there'd been a lot of turmoil and instability at the top and a lot of external pressure, that's the kind of organisation where you get a strong organisational culture. And they can almost... And I think there's a sense early on that, well, who are you? You're the new CEO. Fine, how long are you going to be here for? We're the true believers, you know, we're here for the long haul, and we'll sit and watch and see what you're like before we decide we'll follow you or not. One of the things we did quite early on was we talked a lot about organisational values. We came up with a set of organisational values, and we talked about them quite a lot, about dealing with each other with integrity and respect and collegiality and a sense of innovation in the organisation. And I think over time when people started citing them back at me, I thought that was quite a positive case. You know, we can't do that because that wouldn't be in line with our values, you know, calling me to account around the values. So that was a good organisational point, really. And so I think you can do that. I think you've just got to... The organisation has to sense that you mean it and that you're authentic, and you've got to actually stick with these things and be consistent and live by them over time. But, yeah, and I think it's a long haul, those things, because I think... The cultural things you're trying to change have been embedded and grown for a long period of time, and you've got to be pretty consistent in sticking with those things.
Right. So a long period of time to affect the culture of a big organisation like the ABC. John, what about politicians? Are politicians of either side, apolitical, are they able to affect the culture of our country, or is that mission impossible?
Look, I think really I'd see it as almost, not quite, but almost mission impossible. Paul Keating once said, when the Prime Minister changes, the country changes. I don't actually really believe that. Think of some of the really great figures of the 20th, in a democracy. Let's just keep ourselves to democracy. I mean, did a Churchill really change the culture of Great Britain? I don't know that he really did. I think the real nature of a culture is more determined by the prevailing belief systems and the values those belief systems drive and the behaviour and the ethics that derive out of them. And I think culturally for Australia, the reality is that we've quite quickly gone from a situation where, whether you went to church or not, you saw Christianity as broadly true and that shaped your worldview. It then became just one of a number of options that are all equally valid. It's now morphed into something that's dangerous and you shouldn't expose your children to it, at least in the minds of many in those who might see themselves, wouldn't name themselves as the sort of progressive establishment in this country. I happen to pretty strongly disagree with them. I really do. But I think it's very, very hard to change that mindset. I think people can have an impact on it, but it is limited unless it happens to be sort of somehow combined with a whole lot of other forces that are taking place. The classic example of that is that I would say the Western social conscience that we so pride ourselves on and somehow assume that is innate in other societies as well, when all the evidence suggests that it isn't, stems, in our case, largely from the anti-slavery movement. And you had the coming together of a whole range of things. One of them, one of the very potent ones, was disgust by the masses at the way the leaders of the day behaved. And then you had brilliant people like Wilberforce able to tap in to that mood for change and for that broadening recognition that I think probably largely came out of the Reformation, that you can't just have this idea that the only people who matter are the wealthy and the powerful and the dissolute at the top, because that's what many of them were. Little people matter too, and by extension, so do African slaves. They're human as well. There's a whole set of influences that came together to massively reshape Western culture. But I think those moments are very, very rare, frankly.
Okay. We've got a question about do you have, in your own lives and so on, do you have role models in terms of leadership? Is there anyone that you think that you... or another question here, where did you learn your leadership skills from? Have you got comments on that? If you do, great. If you don't, I have another one up my sleeve.
What else you got, Al? You know, I think I look at effective moments of leadership, and you see different ones at different times. One of the ones I'm interested in at the moment is looking at David Thodey at Telstra. You know, Telstra 4 years ago was viewed as it was a bit of a cot case. All these people had bought shares in Telstra, all their money was underwater. You know, had the three amigos, the bad relationship in Canberra. Telstra was a problem. Now Telstra is kind of top performing stock. The share price is up. It's not in the headlines anymore. Calmed it all down. And I just think, wow, that's an interesting moment. There are some who would have thought that was impossible to do, but there's something about that leadership style and that approach, that communication method, the alignment of the strategy for the people internally and what they're trying to do, that all of a sudden has turned that organisation around. And you look at that and you think, well, you know, and I talk with them about the systematic, measured way of setting strategies, setting priorities, aligning your people, staying on message, that has somehow turned one of the biggest organisations in the country around to be really very effective. And that's been around an aligned board, a strong management team, and the execution of that. And I think you just keep looking at looking for different examples at different moments, I find. And particularly when you see a turnaround or you see an organisation that now looks markedly different to what it once was and the way that everyone perceived it to be, you kind of start digging into that story a bit and trying to find out how people did that. And I think one of the challenges, one of the things about being in media is that if you look at what are the dominant digital companies in the world, you know, companies like Google and Apple and Amazon, a lot of these, you know, started in a garage with two or three people, and then they have grown and successfully taken advantage of their opportunities. One of the things that I look at are what are the big organisations that somehow transformed themselves and turned themselves around and reinvented themselves from being an old-style organisation to a new-style organisation. And how do you get the big ship to turn, the elephant to pivot and dance? How do you bring that about? And so they're things that I look at pretty closely.
Okay. John?
Well, I saw the question as relating more to, for me, to whom I might seek to emulate. Look, for me as a Christian believer, the servant model of leadership that Christ presents us with, sacrificing all, not just for his friends, but even for his enemies, is immensely powerful. And, you know, it's the antidote to pride, the thing you talked about earlier. You know, this monstrous problem that C.S. Lewis said is a precursor to just about every ill mankind's devised and perpetrates. The idea somehow that you can be the centre of your own universe. So that's terribly important to me. And then I suppose I mentioned Wilberforce. I think his model of carrying that forth during his short years on life, enormously influential in the setting up of this country and its values. It wasn't just that he had Richard Johnson put on the early ships. This is the first country in the world, in the modern world, where slavery was outlawed. I don't know how many of you knew that, but the sailing orders for the first fleet, no slaves in the new colony, thanks to the emancipists and the people back in England. It helped that William Wilberforce, you know, had a nephew in the Foreign Office. Always helpful if you've got the wherewithal to do these things. As Margaret Thatcher apparently once remarked, the Good Samaritan wouldn't have been able to do very much if he hadn't had a bob in his pocket. But that's the way it goes, you know. Yep. Use the tools at your disposal wisely.
So I did a little research. Transparency International publish yearly a rating of nations on the basis of corruption or perceived corruption. There's 174 countries that they list. We were number 7, so we're not in for a gold medal, but we're doing okay in terms of 7th from the best. Do you think, John or Mark, that what are some of the reasons? Now, that's showing that our leadership here, national, business and so on, is pretty solid. Are there reasons that we're like that as a nation?
Absolutely.
You want to expand a little
bit? Well, have a look at the scale. This is incredibly bad news for the new atheists. This is a really... How many of you are aware of it, Transparency International? German, I think it is.
It's a website. You can just Google it.
Google it. It's well worth having a look at. If you have a look at it, it's the clearest demonstration you could ever hope for, that belief systems influence and massively shape the values and the behaviour and the ethics, the sort of moral tone of a community. Because what it shows is it's essentially the Christian nations that are atop of it. But what's even in some ways even more interesting is guess who's at the bottom? The countries that have had long flirtations with atheistic regimes. Those of you who are interested in this debate, I'm fascinated by the new atheism. We have Christopher Hitchens here. I mean, sadly, he's passed on. Here he was in Sydney a little while ago. I think, Mark, you might have been one of them. There were 39 of us, I think, participating in, what was it called?
Inspiring people.
There were actually 38 plus me, okay? But here we were in Sydney in 2009 doing a series of this sort of thing almost around the city with Carl Faze as the moderator. And we're all proclaiming our beliefs in the risen Christ. Well, down at the Opera House, you've got the world's leading thinker, I suppose he was, atheistic advocate at that stage, saying only an infantile mind believes that story. Well, his brother, Peter Hitchens, has written a book called The Rage Against God, How Atheism Converted Me to Christianity. He lived in atheist Russia. And he said, must we learn it all again in the West? We seem to be determined to do to ourselves voluntarily what the Russians had forced on them for so long. Can't we learn the lessons there? You know, we trash God, we ridicule him, we push him out of the public square, then we go on to do things like trash marriage and family and wonder at the mayhem. It's a very, very interesting chart. Ask yourself, who's at the bottom as much as why are there people at the top?
Transparency International. You're going to have a look. But one more interesting question here. I think the last one.
I think the ABC was backing that conference.
And
possibly. I wouldn't be the least bit surprised. let me add. Look, I understand that view, John, as well. But I think there are some of the other characteristics that then have evolved in a country like Australia. I think are very important. And I would say that a free and independent press. You look at those countries that are high in transparency. There'll be an absolute correlation with a free and independent press. There'll be an absolute correlation with the strength of the rule of law. And you look at what's happening in this city now, I mean, which inquiry do you want to go to? The only place getting bigger crowds are the ICAC or the Waterhouse inquiry than this event. Because in a sense, I think we have established these traditions where we hold our leaders to account, where the media does investigate and ask tough questions, where you have a strong rule of law that comes to bear on the back of that as well. And that, I think, is also deeply in our culture, that sense of investigation and accountability and consequences that need to be paid if people fall short of that. And I think we're constantly shocked at times by revelations at the ICAC about what's been happening in our midst, and I think that just drives the system further. to ask, are journalists doing their job? Are the police doing their job? Are investigators doing their job? And are we creating the kind of society that we expect to have?
A couple of points out of that. I thought you might.
Yeah.
Firstly, I would say those values, you know, relating to free press and transparency and accountability have their same origins, frankly. You know, based on the principle that our forefathers, with their worldview, developed this idea that one American encapsulated as we're so good we had to give ourselves a vote, we're so bad we had to give ourselves a vote. You understand the principle behind that. But secondly, I would say to you, I think, and you need not respond to this, but I think there are many Australians who wonder actually just how free the press is now, given that so many of them actually hold a worldview that is quite dismissive of our cultural heritage. Are they not enslaved to a set of values that they find very hard to put to one side when they want to evaluate these big questions about who we are and how we came to be free? How many journalists would really accurately track through why it is that that chart is falling out the way that it is? Because there are implications in the middle as well, aren't there? It tells you something profound, I would say to you, about the impact on people on Main Street that derive from the essential beliefs and core values of that society.
Mark, have you I suppose I'd simply say
I think journalists have always had points of view, and journalists have always had a responsibility to act responsibly. And I know I won't speak on behalf of the Australian media, but on behalf of the Australian media, I can speak on behalf of. I think we have clear guidelines, clear expectations around fairness, balance, impartiality, asking questions with respect. Being a town square, we talk about being a town square where all views, all perspectives, the debate can be raged without us actually having a clear point of view ourselves. So that's what we try and do. And I think one of the things I suppose I've tried to do at the ABC is to ensure that we have created forums for debate and discussion. And that's what Q&A is about, and that's what Insider is about, and that is what News 24 is about, and that's what The Drum is about. And that's why we have people like you on it, John. That's why we had people like Christopher Hitchens on it. That's why we have the debate. And we finally have that debate, and we let the audience make up its own mind on these things. And if, in fact, we find journalists cannot exercise their skills professionally by hosting a conversation in a way that represents fairness, balance and impartiality, there are consequences for that, and we deal with that. But that's the kind of environment that we try and create, I suppose.
Okay. And good on you, and I take nothing away from that. I simply make the observation that in America, to choose on a pick on America, a major study a few years ago of players in the press and the media, television, the whole bit, found that essentially their belief systems were nowhere near aligned with middle America's. And I think that's a real issue.
But I think that
I know you battle.
The only thing I'd say about that is that might be true, but I don't think that's particularly relevant, because what we're saying to them is, how do you act as a journalist? So it doesn't matter if you vote Labor, Liberal, Green, Calathumpian. It doesn't matter. What matters is, how do you ask those questions? How do you host that conversation? Are all views included? Are you creating that kind of environment? And that's our test, actually. Our test is what they do when the microphone is open, not even what they think, certainly not how they vote. And that's how we judge them, and that's how we assess them, and that's the environment that we create.
No, I certainly hugely respect you, Mark, for your commitment to those. I certainly would want to say that.
Gentlemen, thank you. I wish we had more time. We have got people who have got to get back to work. Ladies and gentlemen, in your program, you'll find a response form. Be great. We'd love to hear from you, and particularly if you might like information about other things that City Bible Forum does. And we'd value if you could give us some details and just hand that in at the door as you head out. Tomorrow, we have John Anderson and Andrew Scipione, the New South Wales Police Commissioner. The details will be on a leaflet as you leave. It's at Chapter House, which is on the Bathurst Street side of St Andrew's Cathedral, up near the Town Hall. And that will run at the same time of day. And next week, we have Jim Wallace, a former brigadier and commander of the SAS, to speak to us on the topic of leadership. Would you thank John and Mark for their time today?
Thanks, mate.
Good.
Have a great afternoon.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.